Welcome back to The Deep Dive, the show where we distill, that huge ocean of information into those potent, surprising insights crafted just for you. Today, we're embarking on a really captivating journey, I think. It's one that takes us right into the heart of what, what many have called India's living pharmacy. We're going to uncover a veritable treasure trove of natural wellness secrets, wisdom that has, for literally millennia, shaped health and healing across the subcontinent. And is now, more than ever, really captivating global interest.
That's a perfect way to frame it, actually. We're not just talking about a collection of plants here. We're exploring this incredibly comprehensive source of traditional health wisdom, a real treasure trove, like you said. It offers natural products rooted in, ancient texts, but also, and this is key, increasingly validated by modern scientific scrutiny. And at the very core of all this wisdom lies Ayurveda.
Right, Ayurveda.
Yeah. Its name itself, often translated as the discipline of life or maybe knowledge of longevity, really speaks to its profound scope. It's far more than just a medical system. It's described as a conglomeration of various nature-driven preventative and curative approaches. It understands human health holistically so, encompassing physical, mental, social, and spiritual well-being, all seen as integral to achieving what Ayurveda calls total quality of life.
Okay, so for you, our listener, what's the mission of this particular deep dive? What can you expect to, really gain from tuning in today? We're going to embark on this fascinating exploration of some truly unique natural products, all originating from India. We'll peel back the layers, try to understand their profound historical uses, and then importantly, we'll bridge that with a look at their contemporary scientific understanding. And finally, we'll connect the dots to reveal their deep, their really fundamental role within that larger framework of Ayurvedic medicine.
Yeah, our overarching aim here is precisely that, to bridge that fascinating gap between the ancient wisdom and the modern scientific validation. We want to show how these traditional practices, they aren't just relics of the past, right?
Right.
They're actually gaining credibility and acceptance on a global scale, increasingly so. So this is about understanding not just what these products are, but really delving into why they matter so significantly today and how a traditional system like Ayurveda is, actively finding its place in these contemporary evidence-based approaches to health and well-being.
All right, let's really dive in then. Let's unpack this with our first botanical powerhouse, a name I think most listeners will recognize. It's become pretty ubiquitous in the wellness world. Ashwagandha, or Withania somnifera. It's often referred to as an Indian Rasayana drug, and for good reason, apparently.
Oh, absolutely. And that reason is deeply, deeply rooted in Ayurvedic philosophy. You see, in Ayurveda, Rasayana therapy is all about rejuvenation and vitalization. The word itself literally means something like the path of essence.
Path of essence.
Yeah. It aims for the formation of best qualities of dhatis, which basically means the fundamental cells and tissues of the body. This whole approach leads to an improved physiological state, better immunity, increased vitality, improved mental competence, and ultimately, greater longevity.
Oh, okay.
And ashwagandha has this long, long history within that framework. It's traditionally used for promoting strength, both of the heart and the overall body. It was used for addressing conditions like, what ancient texts might describe as insanity or chronic mental agitation. And also for combating persistent inflammation. Plus, it's celebrated as an ojas building herb.
Ojas. What exactly is ojas in Ayurvedic terms?
Right. Ojas is a really crucial concept. It represents this vital, subtle, almost sap-like material that's believed to coat the immune system and protect the body from disease. It's essentially the essence of vitality and immunity.
Got it. Okay. Now, this is where the ancient wisdom, as you said, really converges with modern understanding in a pretty compelling way, isn't it?
Yeah.
Ashwagandha has been researched extensively, identified as a powerful adaptogen. Now, for our listeners, what does adaptogen truly signify in, practical terms?
That's an excellent question and a really important one. Mm. An adaptogen is basically a substance that helps the body adapt to stress. And that stress could be physical, it could be chemical, or even biological. It works by normalizing physiological functions.
So it doesn't just treat a symptom.
Exactly. It helps the body find balance, its equilibrium. Ashwagandha specifically is noted for its significant anti-stress effect, which is, a key reason for its huge popularity today. What's particularly intriguing, I think, is that research suggests its potency as an adaptogen is really notable, even at lower effective doses when you compare it to other, maybe more widely known adaptogens like, say, Chinese ginseng, which speaks to its unique pharmacological profile.
So it's not just a general stress reliever, but potentially something more potent or maybe more efficient at lower doses. Can you delve a bit into the scientific mechanisms researchers are uncovering? What's actually going on there?
Certainly. Well, scientific findings point towards a humoral basis for its anti-stress and anti-inflammatory effect, which means it influences various bodily fluids and systems, think endocrine system, immune system, to achieve those balancing effects.
Okay.
But the research goes even further into some really fascinating areas. For instance, in vitro studies, so experiments done in a lab setting, like in a test tube or petri dish.
Right, not in humans yet for these specific ones.
Exactly. These studies have shown noticeable neuritic regenerative effects of withanolide. Now, ethanolide A is a key compound isolated from ashwagandha. Essentially, what this means is it appears to help nerve cells in the brain grow and repair their extensions, which are crucial for communication between neurons.
Wow, nerve regeneration.
Potentially, yeah, at least in these lab settings. And additionally, other compounds, specifically identified as cholinesterase inhibiting with withanolides, have been found. Now, cholinesterase is an enzyme that breaks down acetylcholine. Acetylcholine is a neurotransmitter critical for memory and learning.
Oh.
So by inhibiting this enzyme, ashwagandha might help maintain higher levels of acetylcholine, potentially supporting cognitive function. There's also some emerging interest in its potential amyloid-reducing effects in the context of neurodegenerative diseases, but its impact on nerve regeneration and neurotransmitter balance is particularly promising right now.
And it's not just lab findings, is it? You mentioned clinical validation supporting its benefits. What have the human studies actually shown?
Indeed, yeah, the research has definitely moved beyond the lab. One quite notable study conducted with elderly volunteers, it actually revealed a significant reduction in the rate of biological aging, BAS. Now, BAS stands for Biological Aging Score, and it's a measure that assesses various physiological markers to estimate a person's biological age versus their, chronological age.
Right. So lower score is better.
Precisely. A reduction in this score suggests that ashwagandha might genuinely help slow down certain aspects of the aging process at a cellular level. And furthermore, that same study also showed an improvement in mental health status as measured by BPRS.
BPRS. Yeah.
Yeah, BPRS is the Brief Psychiatric Rating Scale. It's a widely used clinical tool for assessing various psychological symptoms. So, seeing improvements on both biological aging markers and mental well-being measures in a clinical setting, well, that makes a pretty compelling case, doesn't it? For this ancient herb really finding its place in modern discussions around vitality, cognitive health, and just overall well-being.
Absolutely. That's really convincing stuff. Okay, moving from a celebrated adaptogen like ashwagandha, let's turn our attention to another foundational botanical, neem or Azadirachta indica. This plant is affectionately and I think very accurately referred to as the village pharmacy throughout India. Its presence is truly widespread and its cultural significance, well, you just can't overstate it.
No, you really can't. It's profoundly embedded in the culture. Neem holds this deep esteem in Indian mythology. It's often considered sacred. You'll frequently find it planted near temples and homes. It's more than just a plant, it's really a symbol of health and purity. There's even this ancient belief that hanging neem twigs on house doors offers protection against pollution and disease.
Wow.
Yeah, it's a testament to its long-held reputation as a kind of cleanser and protector. This blend of, practical application and cultural reverence really speaks volumes about its role in daily life for centuries.
And its versatility in traditional uses is just astounding. What are some of the most common ways it's been utilized over the years?
Well, historically, neem has been the go-to remedy for an incredible array of common ailments. It's widely used as an insect and mosquito repellent. Just a natural deterrent. For personal care, its leaves are often boiled, and then the water is used for reducing dandruff and generally promoting scalp health. It's also traditionally applied topically for alleviating joint pain, likely due to its anti-inflammatory properties. But beyond those, its uses extend even further. It's been used to address ear inflammation, and it's been prized as an antiparasitical, an alterative, which means it helps restore healthy bodily functions, an aromatic, a vermifuge, which is for expelling intestinal worms, and just a general pain reliever. It really is a comprehensive natural toolkit, often the first line of defense in many rural households, even today.
It really sounds like a true multitasker. So, what gives neem all this incredible power? It must be down to its complex chemistry, right?
Precisely. Neem possesses this really complex array of bioactive compounds that seem to work synergistically. The sources specifically highlight azadirachtin, which is found predominantly in its seeds. That's the one well known for its potent insecticidal and repellent properties. But it also contains other significant compounds like nimbulide and nimbidin. Azadirachtin itself is quite remarkable. It has this unique molecular structure with numerous oxygen-bearing functional groups. And this intricate structure is thought to be directly responsible for its diverse biological activities, making it highly effective against pests and various pathogens. It's like nature packed a highly specialized toolkit all within one plant.
Fascinating. Okay, transitioning from the village pharmacy, let's talk about turmeric, Curcuma longa, often dubbed the golden healer. Its vibrant golden hue is instantly familiar, isn't it, to anyone who enjoys Indian cuisine? It's an indispensable staple there, but its reputation as a healer far precedes its culinary use.
Absolutely. Turmeric is globally renowned now for its well-known anti-inflammatory and antioxidant properties. Those are really foundational to many of its perceived health benefits. In traditional medicine, it's been used extensively for regulating pancreas and liver functions, particularly in the early stages of diabetes. And it's also applied topically, sometimes as an eye wash or a salve for various skin conditions. The key active compound driving much of this global demand and the scientific interest is, of course, curcumin.
Right, curcumin. So on one hand, we have this incredible natural product, ancient roots, modern scientific validation. Seems like a win-win. But this is where, as you mentioned earlier about bridging gaps, it gets really nuanced. The increasing global demand for turmeric has actually introduced some significant environmental challenges, which, often go unnoticed by the average consumer just buying it off the shelf.
That's a really critical point to consider and something we need to be more aware of. While turmeric itself is this natural wonder, its expanding cultivation, particularly when done using conventional farming practices, can unfortunately lead to several negative environmental impacts. One major concern is deforestation. Farmers might clear existing land, potentially including forests, to make way for new turmeric crops to meet demand. Furthermore, the intensive use of synthetic pesticides and fertilizers in non-organic cultivation can result in considerable water pollution through agricultural runoff. This runoff carries harmful chemicals into nearby rivers and water bodies, contaminating water sources and severely harming aquatic ecosystems. It presents a clear paradox, doesn't it? A natural remedy whose production, if not managed carefully, can actually strain the very natural resources we rely on.
That's a powerful insight that our demand for wellness products can sometimes inadvertently contribute to ecological harm. What are the solutions then? Or are there growing trends to try and mitigate these impacts?
Well, the good news is there's definitely a rapidly growing awareness about this and a strong push for sustainable sourcing practices within the turmeric industry. This includes actively promoting methods like agroforestry, where turmeric is grown alongside trees. This helps maintain biodiversity and soil health. Reforestation initiatives are also being encouraged to help reverse land degradation where it's occurred. And furthermore, organic farming methods, which completely avoid synthetic chemicals, and natural pest control techniques are being adopted more widely to protect water quality and ecosystem health. These approaches really emphasize the importance of considering the entire supply chain's environmental footprint. Aiming for a balance where the global demand for this golden healer can coexist with ecological preservation. It's about making conscious choices, really, from the farm all the way to the consumer.
That's good to hear. Okay, from the golden healer, let's now move to the Indian gooseberry of immortality, as it's sometimes called. Amla, or Emblica officinalis. This one sounds like a nutritional superstar, truly a powerhouse of health benefits, and deeply revered in Ayurveda.
It absolutely is. Amla is specifically highlighted for its extraordinary richness in vitamin C. I mean, far more than oranges, for example. But its traditional uses go way beyond just that single nutrient. It's been used traditionally for centuries for improving digestion, bolstering immune support, and promoting overall health. It plays a crucial role, apparently, in maintaining microbiome homeostasis. That's the healthy balance of gut bacteria, which we now know is vital for digestion and immunity. And like ashwagandha, it's also considered an ojas-building herb, actively supporting that vital life sap we talked about, boosting vitality and resistance.
And its therapeutic applications are described as truly extensive and remarkably diverse. Can you elaborate a bit on how widely it's used in traditional practice?
Certainly. The sources really underscore its profound impact on the immune system. They note it significantly boosts immunity, strengthens the body's natural defenses against pathogens, and helps fight infections more effectively. For digestive health, it really shines. It improves digestion by stimulating digestive juices, provides beneficial fiber to prevent constipation, and actively aids detoxification processes, helping the body eliminate waste. It has even proven notably effective in clinical settings for reducing symptoms of gastroesophageal reflux disease, GERD, heartburn and regurgitation, offering a natural approach to these really common discomforts.
What's truly fascinating here, I think, is the modern validation that's emerging, showing just how potentially cutting edge this ancient wisdom can be. I'm particularly intrigued by the mention of its potential interaction with viruses, especially given recent years.
Yes, it's a very exciting area of research right now. There's compelling in silico evidence, remember? That means findings from computer simulations and modeling.
Right, computational studies.
Exactly. This evidence suggests that amylase phytochemicals could act as potential protease inhibitors of the SARS-CoV-2 virus. To break that down a bit, protease inhibitors are a class of antiviral drugs. They work by blocking the activity of proteases, which are enzymes that viruses, like SARS-CoV-2, absolutely need to replicate themselves inside our host cells.
Okay, so stopping the virus from multiplying.
That's the idea. So this in silico evidence, while it's not definitive proof on its own, it needs lab and clinical follow-up, it's a powerful screening tool. And it raises this really important question for future research. How might this traditional remedy contribute to novel antiviral strategies, perhaps even for future pandemics? It really highlights that dynamic interplay between ancient botanical knowledge and cutting-edge scientific inquiry.
Absolutely fascinating potential there. Okay, before we transition fully into the overarching holistic framework of Ayurveda itself, let's have a brief but I think significant mention of reserpine. It's derived from Rowolfia serpentina, commonly known as Indian snake root. This plant serves as such a powerful historical example of how ancient wisdom directly informed the development of modern medicine.
It's a perfect bridge between those two worlds, isn't it? Rowolfia serpentina was used for centuries in Ayurvedic medicine. It was known as a tranquilizer and a remedy for conditions ranging from high blood pressure to, well, what they termed insanity, also fevers, and even snake bite. Its medicinal value was well documented in ancient Indian texts, showcasing this long history of clinical observation.
Mm-hmm.
The breakthrough into modern Western medicine really came after an Indian physician, Rustam J. Vakil, published his landmark 1949 report. That report definitively demonstrated its potent blood pressure lowering effect.
And that report essentially triggered a major pharmaceutical discovery, right?
Exactly. Pharmaceutical chemists at Seba in Switzerland, they then successfully isolated reserpine in 1952, identifying it as the main active compound responsible for those effects. It's just such a powerful illustration of a single natural compound from an ancient medicinal plant becoming a foundational modern drug. There's even that fascinating anecdote that Mahatma Gandhi himself reportedly took the root as a calming herbal remedy.
Wow.
Which really underscores the deep roots of these natural products, influencing figures of historical significance and directly impacting the development of modern pharmaceuticals.
Yeah, a clear lineage, as you said. Okay, so now let's move into that broader, comprehensive framework that underpins so much of what we've just discussed. Ayurveda itself, the science of life. It's a truly holistic system, isn't it? Far more than just a collection of herbal remedies. Its core principles seem to revolve around these concepts of prakriti, individual constitution, and the tridosha vata, pitta, and kapha. Okay, let's unpack this, because this feels like where Ayurveda truly differentiates itself, offering this profoundly personalized approach to health. It's definitely not one size fits all. So how do prakriti and tridosha work together to form this unique blueprint for individual health?
That's a crucial distinction, yeah. Your prakriti is essentially your unique blueprint. It's your inherent constitution, believed to be determined at conception. It's the unique combination or blend of the three doshas, vata, pitta, and kapha, that governs your physical, mental, and emotional characteristics. These doshas are the fundamental constructs for understanding individual health and, crucially, for identifying imbalances when they occur.
Okay.
So to give you a brief overview, vata is associated with the elements of air and ether. It governs all movement in the body, breathing, circulation, nerve impulses, elimination, everything. A vata-dominant person might naturally be light, energetic, creative, maybe quick-thinking, but also prone to dryness, anxiety, and perhaps irregular digestion or sleep patterns. When vata gets imbalanced, they might experience things like coldness, joint pain, insomnia, or nervous jitters.
Okay, vata is movement and dryness.
Pretty much. Then you have pitta, which is linked to fire and a bit of water. It governs transformation and heat sink digestion, metabolism, body temperature, even intelligence and understanding. A Pitta person might be fiery, sharp, ambitious, focused, and often have strong digestion. But when they're out of balance, they can be prone to inflammation, anger, irritability, skin rashes, or things like acid indigestion.
Heat and transformation for Pitta. Got it.
And finally, Kapha. Kapha relates to earth and water. It provides structure, lubrication, stability, and cohesion in the body. It governs body mass, lubrication of joints, moisture in the skin, and also immune function. A Kapha individual tends to be calm, grounded, compassionate, physically strong, with good stamina. But when Kapha is imbalanced, they might become susceptible to sluggishness, weight gain, congestion, like in the sinuses or lungs, fluid retention, or maybe emotional attachment and lethargy.
Structure and stability for Kapha.
Okay. Wow.
So understanding which dosha or combination of doshas is dominant in your prakriti,
yeah,
your basic nature, or maybe if one is currently out of balance due to lifestyle, diet, stress, environment, whatever, that guides the entire personalized wellness journey in Ayurveda.
Exactly. It influences pretty much every aspect of life, starting profoundly with dietary adjustments. Ayurveda places huge emphasis on balancing the six tastes.
Six tastes.
Yes, sweet, sour, salty, pungent, like spicy, bitter, and astringent, like unripe banana or tea. Different tastes affect the different doshas in specific ways. So individuals adjust their intake of these tastes and also specific foods based on their prakriti and even the changing seasons to maintain or restore dosha balance. For example, a Vata person, being inherently cool and dry, generally needs more warm, moist, heavy, grounding foods to find balance. Think warm soups, stews, root vegetables, healthy oils. A Pitta person, being naturally hot and intense, would typically benefit from cooling, slightly drier, maybe less spicy foods. Things like cucumbers, sweet fruits, leafy greens, coconut. And a Kapha person, who tends towards heaviness and coolness, might need more pungent, bitter, and astringent foods to stimulate their metabolism and reduce congestion. Think spices, beans, lighter grains, steamed vegetables.
That makes sense. Can you give some specific food examples from the sources? You mentioned some general do's and don'ts.
Right. So the sources mention that foods like preserved items, pork, beef, fish, heavy curd or yogurt, barley, and black beans are generally not recommended for regular consumption across all dosha types. They're seen as potentially heavy, hard to digest, or likely to create ama, which are those metabolic toxins we talked about.
Got it. Avoid those generally.
Yeah, for regular use. On the other hand, certain varieties of rice, fresh cow's milk, often boiled with spices, amla, which we just discussed, natural rock salt, ghee, which is clarified butter and highly prized, and cowpea, a type of legume, are highly recommended for regular use. These are seen as generally balancing, health promotive, and restorative for most constitutions. It's truly about mindful, individualized eating, really turning your food into your medicine based on your unique needs.
That's a beautiful example of how food choices are so deeply personalized. What about other key lifestyle practices beyond just what you eat?
Oh, absolutely. Another crucial daily practice in Ayurveda is Abhyanga. That's self-oil massage.
Self-massage with oil.
Yeah. This isn't just about, you know, making your skin soft, although it does that too. You typically rub warm, often herb-infused oil over your entire head and body before taking a bath or shower. And crucially, the type of oil is specifically chosen to balance your dominant dosha.
Ah, personalized again.
Exactly. For instance, the sources say warm sesame oil is recommended for Vata. Why? Because sesame oil is warming and heavy, grounding, which directly counteracts Vata's inherent dryness and coldness. For Pitta, which tends towards heat and irritability, warm sunflower or perhaps coconut oil is prescribed because those oils are naturally cooling and calming. And for Kapha, which can be heavy, cool, maybe a bit sluggish, warm sunflower or even mustard oil might be used as they are more stimulating and invigorating, helping to move stagnation.
Wow.
This practice isn't just skin deep. It's believed to deeply nourish the tissues, support the lymphatic system for detoxification, induce sound sleep, calm the entire nervous system, and help prevent various imbalances associated with dryness, aging, and stress. It's real daily self-care.
That's a wonderful example of that individualization and, yeah, daily self-care. I've also heard of pulse diagnosis being a core traditional diagnostic method in Ayurveda.
Yeah.
How does that fit in with detecting these dosha imbalances?
Yes. Pulse dosha detection, or Nadi Pariksha, as it's called, is a highly refined traditional diagnostic method performed by experienced Ayurvedic practitioners, or Vaidyas. They very lightly place their index, middle, and ring fingers on specific pulse positions on the patient's wrist, usually the radial artery. The characteristics of the pulse, its rate, rhythm, volume, force, and importantly, how it feels under each specific finger are believed to reveal imbalances in the doshas.
How so? Like, what do they feel?
Well, traditionally, if the pulse is felt most prominently and perhaps erratically, like a quick slithering movement under the index finger, it suggests a Vata dosha imbalance. It's often described as a snake-like movement. If the pulse feels strongest, maybe more bounding or jumping under the middle finger, that points towards a Pitta imbalance, sometimes described as having a frog-like quality. And if the pulse is primarily felt as slow, steady, maybe gliding under the ring finger, that indicates a Kapha dosha imbalance, often described poetically as a swan-like glide.
Interesting analogies.
They are, aren't they? And while these are definitely subjective assessments requiring years of training and sensitivity, it's part of the comprehensive, multifaceted assessment used in Ayurveda to identify subtle energetic imbalances that might precede more obvious physical symptoms.
So it's clear that Ayurveda truly goes way beyond just herbal remedies. It's genuinely a whole medical system, as the sources say, integrating this wide range of practices.
Yeah.
What are some of the other key lifestyle elements that are integral to Ayurvedic living?
Well, beyond the diet and the Abhyanga massage, there's a profound emphasis on practices that really integrate the mind, body, and spirit. This definitely includes yoga and pranayama. Specific yoga poses, or asanas, are often prescribed not just for physical flexibility and strength, but more specifically to balance particular doshas, to channel energy or prana, to awaken the chakras or energy centers along the spine, and to stimulate agni, the digestive fire. For example, poses like dhanurasana, that's bow pose, ardha matsyendrasana, half lord of the fishes pose, a spinal twist, bhujangasana, cobra pose, satubandha sarvangasana, bridge pose, and even simple things like a wall squatting pose are often recommended for their various benefits, improving digestion, strengthening the spine, opening the chest, calming the mind, depending on the pose and how it's practiced.
And pranayama, those breathing techniques, they seem equally central, right?
Absolutely critical. Breathing techniques like Mrtya Kumbhaka, which is sometimes called the swooning breath, are not just simple exercises for the lungs. They are seen as profound tools for physical and mental well-being. These practices enhance lung aeration, yes, but they also soothe the nervous system, help cleanse subtle energy channels called nadis, help balance the doshas, and crucially, channel prana, that vital life force throughout the entire body. The goal is really to regulate the breath as a way to calm the mind and improve overall vitality and awareness.
Makes sense. What about the more mental and spiritual aspects of Ayurvedic holistic living?
These are deeply interwoven, not really seen as separate. Meditation and mantras are considered vital for achieving mental peace, reducing stress, and fostering spiritual harmony. Mantras are sacred sounds, words, or phrases that are repeated, either silently or aloud, during meditation to help focus the mind and evoke specific energies or qualities. For example, the sources mention Shanti is chanted for peace, Ram is believed to offer divine protection and boost immunity, Hum is associated with digestion and clearing channels, and Shreem for overall health, prosperity, and building reproductive tissues.
Interesting.
And meditation itself, you know, it doesn't have to be complicated. It can be practiced anywhere, anytime. You might focus on a mantra or a particular elevating thought, or simply observe nature, focus on your breath, as long as it doesn't cause strain or worry. It's really about cultivating that inner quiet and awareness.
And what about sensory therapies? The outline mentioned a few intriguing ones like aroma and color.
Yes. Ayurveda absolutely embraces therapies that engage all our senses for healing and balance. It recognizes that what we take in through our senses affects our doshas and overall state. So aromatherapy is quite common. It uses natural scents from essential oils like sandalwood, lotus, frankincense, cinnamon, basil, which can be diffused, inhaled, or sometimes applied diluted to the skin. This specific scent is chosen to calm the mind, elevate mood, or alleviate specific imbalances. Sandalwood, for instance, is often used for Pitta because it's cooling. Color therapy, though perhaps less commonly discussed in modern mainstream contexts, is also part of traditional Ayurveda. It's believed to use the subtle vibrations of specific colors to influence the mind and body. Generally, white, yellow, gold, orange, and lighter, brighter shades are considered uplifting and energizing, good for kapha perhaps, while cooler colors might soothe pitta. And even gem therapy exists, where specific gemstones like emerald, jade, or yellow sapphire are traditionally set in gold or silver and worn on the body, touching the skin. They are believed to transmit beneficial energies or vibrations to calm the mind, strengthen certain planetary influences in one's astrological chart, which is often considered alongside Ayurveda, and uplift the spirit. It's truly about creating a harmonious environment, both within yourself and around you, using all available natural means.
That's a truly comprehensive approach, isn't it? Encompassing so many layers of well-being. Okay, now let's delve into something that sounds quite, well, intense, but is described as a cornerstone of Ayurvedic detox, Panchakarma. What exactly is this deep cleansing therapy?
Right, Panchakarma is often described as the signature Ayurvedic detoxification and rejuvenation therapy. Allied therapies are also involved. Its core aim is to methodically loosen and then eliminate accumulated toxins, known in Ayurveda as ama, which you can think of as undigested metabolic waste products, sticky stuff that clogs channels from the body's tissues and especially from the gastrointestinal tract. The goal is to purify the body deeply, thereby restoring dosha balance and improving overall health and function. It's considered a profound purification process, not just a simple cleanse.
And how is this multi-stage process typically structured? It sounds involved.
It is quite involved, yes. And it generally unfolds in three distinct phases, each one really crucial for the overall efficacy. The first is the preliminary phase, known as Purvakarma. This primarily involves two key procedures, Snehana and Swadhana. Snehana means oleation or oil therapy. This could involve consuming specific quantities of warm medicinal ghee or oil for several days, or receiving extensive external oil massage, often with specific medicated oils, again for several days leading up to the main cleanse. Then comes Swadhana, which is therapeutic sudation or sweating. This is often induced through herbal steam baths or other gentle warming methods.
Okay, so oiling up and sweating first. Why?
Good question. These preparatory steps are absolutely crucial. The intense oleation, both internal and external, saturates the body's tissues with oil. This helps to loosen the sticky ama and dislodge it from the deeper tissues where it's stuck. The subsequent sweating, the Swadhana, further liquefies the toxins and helps facilitate the movement of these loosened toxins towards the GI tract, specifically the stomach, small intestine, or colon, making them accessible for elimination in the next phase.
Got it. Mobilizing the toxins first. So once those toxins are mobilized into the gastrointestinal tract, what happens next in the main purification phase?
That leads directly into the primary purificatory practices, known as Pradhanakarma. These are the five main actions. Panchakarma literally means five actions, although not all five are necessarily used for every person. The five are, one, vamana. This is therapeutic vomiting or emesis. It's primarily used to eliminate excess kapha and accumulated toxins from the stomach and upper respiratory tract. Two, Virachana. This is therapeutic purgation, usually using specific herbs that cleanse the small intestine and liver gallbladder area. It's primarily used to eliminate excess pitta and associated toxins and to purify the blood. Three, Basti. This refers to medicated enemas. It's actually considered the most important and powerful of the five karmas, particularly for vata imbalances. It involves administering herbal oils or decoctions rectally to cleanse the colon, calm the nervous system, and deliver nourishment directly. There are many types of Basti. Four, Nasya. This involves the administration of medicated oils or herbal preparations into the nasal passages. It's used to cleanse, purify, and nourish the head region, benefiting conditions related to the sinuses, brain, eyes, ears, and nervous system. It targets imbalances above the clavicle. Five, Raktamukshana. This is therapeutic bloodletting. It's the least commonly used of the five today and is highly specialized, reserved for specific conditions believed to be rooted in impure blood, such as certain persistent skin disorders or localized inflammation. It might involve leech therapy or careful withdrawal of small amounts of blood.
Wow. Okay. That is intense. And you said these are chosen individually.
Absolutely. Each of these five actions, or a combination of them, is meticulously selected by the Ayurvedic practitioner based on the individual patient's specific dosha imbalance, which doshas aggravated and wear, their current health condition, their age, strength, the season, and their underlying Ayurvedic constitution, Prakriti. It's highly personalized.
And after these intense purificatory practices, what's the final stage? You can't just go straight back to normal life, I imagine.
No.
Definitely not. The final stage is crucial. It involves post-Panchakarma therapies, known as Panchakarma. This phase focuses on gradual reacclimatization and rejuvenation, rasayana, and tonification. It includes following a specific gentle diet, samsarjana krama, that slowly rebuilds digestive strength, introducing foods gradually from very light liquids back to normal solids over several days. It also involves lifestyle recommendations, rest, avoiding stress, avoiding exposure to extremes to consolidate the benefits of the purification and allow the body to rebuild its strength, immunity, and vitality after the deep cleanse. It's important to reiterate that these Panchakarma protocols are highly individualized, meticulously selected for each person. And the entire comprehensive process, including preparation and follow-up, often takes approximately 2-3 weeks to complete, sometimes longer, underscoring its depth and the commitment required.
It's clear that Ayurveda is an incredibly detailed and individualized system, steeped in, well, millennia of observation and practice. But in today's world, there's such a strong and, I think, rightful emphasis on evidence-based approaches in healthcare.
Mm-hmm.
How does Ayurveda, with its ancient roots and unique methodology, fit into this modern imperative for scientific validation?
That's a truly critical point, and it's an area that's actively evolving. There's definitely a growing emphasis on adopting an evidence-based approach as being imperative for Ayurveda to gain broader credibility and acceptance at a global level, particularly within conventional medical communities and regulatory bodies.
Right.
Now, this doesn't mean Ayurveda lacks traditional evidence. Quite the opposite. Its practices are built on thousands of years of recorded clinical experience and detailed textual documentation. Rather, the primary challenge often lies in the dearth of published research and documentation in a format that would be acceptable to modern scientific and regulatory authorities.
Ah, okay. It's a format issue, not necessarily an efficacy issue.
Largely, yes. Traditional Ayurvedic texts often present knowledge through detailed observations, philosophical principles, complex formulations, and individual case descriptions that don't always neatly align with the standardized protocols we expect today. Things like large-scale randomized controlled trials, RCTs, double blinding, placebo controls, or complex statistical analysis. So it's often framed not as a lack of evidence of efficacy per se, but a difference in how that efficacy has historically been documented and therefore how it needs to be translated and presented for modern scientific scrutiny and global acceptance.
So it's really about bridging that methodological gap, then translating that ancient wisdom and observational evidence into a modern scientific language that regulators and the wider scientific community can understand and evaluate. What's being done specifically to overcome this challenge and, you know, validate Ayurvedic practices through rigorous clinical trials?
Precisely. There's a recognized and very active need for appropriate tools and methods of research that can somehow respect both the demands of scientific rigor and Ayurveda's inherently holistic, individualized nature, which isn't always easy.
I can imagine.
Yeah. This includes efforts like encouraging more detailed, standardized reporting of single cases and case series. While not RCTs, these can build a rich, raw data pool for future, larger studies and help generate hypotheses that can then be tested more rigorously. And yes, there are significant ongoing research efforts. Organizations like the Central Council for Research in Ayurveda and CIRA, CCRAS, in India, are actively conducting clinical trials specifically designed to validate Ayurvedic practices using modern methodologies. The sources highlight several examples. They mention double-blind randomized controlled trials again, the gold standard in modern research investigating the efficacy of specific Ayurvedic formulations containing herbs like gugulu, shunthi, which is ginger, and guduchi in conditions like rheumatoid arthritis.
Okay, that's serious research.
Definitely. They're also running trials for conditions like pakshaghata, which relates to paralysis or stroke, mutrishmari, urolithiasis, or kidney bladder stones, and conducting studies on iron deficiency anemia using Ayurvedic approaches. Additionally, there are open clinical trials where both participants and researchers know the treatment being given, looking at traditional rejuvenation formulas called Siddha Kaya Kalpa drugs in healthy elderly persons to assess their effects on aging and vitality.
That sounds quite rigorous indeed. What kind of protocols are these studies following to ensure they have scientific validity and reliability? How do they measure outcomes?
They are employing rigorous protocols that aim to mirror modern clinical research standards as closely as possible within the context of Ayurveda. This typically includes comprehensive initial assessments with complete physical examinations, collection of blood and urine samples for objective biomarker analysis, so measurable biological changes, alongside the traditional Ayurvedic assessments. There are regular follow-up visits to monitor progress over time. Data on both subjective clinical symptoms, how the patient feels, and objective test results like blood markers or imaging are meticulously tabulated. This data is then analyzed using appropriate statistical tools to ensure that any findings are robust and statistically significant, not just due to chance. The monitoring of trial progress is centralized, undertaken by CCRS headquarters in New Delhi, for instance, and laboratory investigations are conducted either at their specialized institutes or identified reputed external labs to ensure quality control and standardization.
And what about the ethical side? Ensuring patient safety is absolutely paramount, especially when you're dealing with human trials of any kind, traditional or modern.
Ethical oversight is indeed paramount, and it's a key focus in these contemporary Ayurvedic studies. The sources really emphasize the crucial role of institutional ethical committees, or IECs. These are independent committees, usually based at the research institutions, that review and must approve all research proposals before any project can begin. This includes scrutinizing detailed patient information sheets and informed consent forms. Their job is to ensure that participants are fully informed about the study, understand the potential risks and benefits, and voluntarily agree to participate, protecting their rights and welfare.
Okay, that's standard practice for good clinical research.
Yes. And additionally, a Data and Safety Monitoring Board, or DSMB, is often established, for example, at CCRAS headquarters for the studies they oversee. This board, composed of independent experts, carefully monitors all incoming data from the ongoing trials. Critically, they monitor any reported side effects or adverse events throughout the entire study period. This board ensures prompt reporting of adverse events and has the authority, based on predefined criteria, to determine if any adverse effects are significant enough to warrant modifying or even discontinuing a study protocol to protect participant safety. There are clear predefined protocols in place for managing and treating any study-related adverse events should they occur. This multi-layered oversight system helps ensure both scientific integrity and, most importantly, participant well-being.
That's very reassuring to hear about that rigorous and ethical framework being applied. However, I have also heard concerns raised, sometimes quite publicly, about safety, specifically regarding the potential presence of heavy metals in some Ayurvedic products. Is that something being actively addressed in the regulatory landscape?
That's a very important and valid safety consideration, yes. And it's certainly something that is being addressed, although it remains a complex issue. While herbal products in general are often perceived as being inherently safer due to their natural origin, the sources we looked at openly acknowledge that some Ayurvedic products may contain heavy metals. These could include mercury, lead, copper, iron, arsenic, cadmium, or nickel.
All right. Why would they be in there?
Well, they can be present for essentially two main reasons. Either they are intentionally included as essential ingredients, particularly in certain traditional preparations called basmas. Basmas are unique Ayurvedic preparations involving elaborate purification and incineration processes of metals, minerals, or sometimes gems, transforming them into a supposedly non-toxic, bioavailable ash form intended for therapeutic use in very specific conditions and small doses under expert guidance. That's one way.
Okay, intentional inclusion in specific formulas.
Yes, or heavy metals might be present as unintentional contaminants. This could happen due to the sourcing of raw herbs from polluted soil or water, or potentially through contamination during the manufacturing or storage processes if quality control is lacking.
I see. So how is India's regulatory framework evolving to address these concerns and ensure product safety, especially for products entering a global market?
India's main legislation governing this, the Drugs and Cosmetics Act and Rules, has undergone significant amendments over the years, specifically to enhance safety and quality control for Ayurvedic, Siddha, and Unani medicines. Historically, expensive clinical trials weren't mandatory for all traditional Ayurvedic products before marketing, given their long history of traditional use, which was considered evidence in itself. However, the law now specifically requires toxicity studies, animal safety studies for formulations that contain ingredients, including herbs or minerals, that are known from texts or modern science to be potentially toxic. Toxicity studies are also required for any new formulations or where safety concerns exist. This demonstrates a clear and progressive move towards enhanced safety validation and greater regulatory oversight by the Indian government and bodies like the Ministry of AUSH. The aim is really to ensure that while this invaluable traditional wisdom is preserved and promoted, the products also meet modern standards for safety and quality, leading eventually to more transparent and predictable outcomes in the wellness landscape, and importantly, building greater trust both domestically and globally. It's definitely a continuous process, this integration of traditional knowledge with contemporary safety and quality standards.
So as we wrap up this really fascinating deep dive, it's just so clear we've unveiled this profound synergy, hasn't it, between India's incredibly rich ethnobotanical heritage and the holistic, deeply individualized principles of Ayurveda. From those powerful, specific plant-based remedies like ashwagandha, neem, turmeric, and amla, right through to the comprehensive lifestyle practices like panchakarma and that whole dosha-based approach to personalized health. It's just such a vast, intricate, and frankly, deeply intelligent system.
Indeed. We've explored how these ancient practices are not just being preserved, but are also being actively viewed and sometimes challenged through a modern scientific lens. This highlights both their enduring traditional efficacy and also the growing and sometimes difficult scientific efforts to validate them for contemporary use. This whole journey really underscores the critical importance of, well, responsible and informed use when exploring these natural products and Ayurvedic practices. It means emphasizing that evolving scientific understanding and also acknowledging and navigating the crucial safety considerations we've discussed, like heavy metals and the need for proper guidance.
Absolutely. And looking to the future, it really feels like we're maybe just at the beginning of truly unlocking and integrating this ancient wisdom with modern healthcare in a meaningful way. This accelerating journey toward evidence-based Ayurveda seems like such a vital step toward achieving those more transparent and predictable outcomes in wellness globally, offering a truly holistic perspective on health that modern medicine sometimes lacks. And this really raises an important question, I think, for you, our listener, to maybe ponder. As research continues, how will these ancient secrets be increasingly validated, integrated, and perhaps made accessible to create a truly global framework for health? One that respects both the depth of tradition and the rigor of modern science.
The potential for deeper understanding is huge. Broader application, truly personalized health solutions, it's immense. It's really about finding that harmonious balance, isn't it? Where scientific rigor meets the profound holistic insights that have remarkably stood the test of time for millennia, hopefully for the benefit of all.
A truly fascinating topic, and clearly one that continues to evolve with every new study, every new insight. Thank you so much for joining us on this deep dive into India's natural pharmacy and Ayurvedic secrets. We hope you feel more informed, maybe a little more inspired perhaps, to explore this incredible heritage responsibly for yourself.